Welcome to the Diary of an African Entrepreneur, where we explore the real stories, strategies, and struggles behind building successful businesses in Africa. I'm your host, Deji Adebusoye. I'm a partner at Sahel Capital, sharing lessons from the front lines of African enterprises. Today, we'll be reviewing the diary of Disha Kopriu, the CEO of Redlands Roses. Redlands Roses is a leading Kenyan flower farm established in 1996 in Ruiru, just outside Nairobi, Kenya. Renowned for producing luxury spray, garden, and tea hybrid roses, the company grows nearly 200 varieties on over 28 hectares using 100% hydroponic systems and fully recycled water. Internationally recognized for its commitment to quality, sustainability, and community impact, Redlands Roses exports millions of premium roses each year to global markets, setting the standard for environmentally responsible floriculture in Africa. Disha, it's a pleasure to have you join us today. Can you tell us about, for the sake of those who are listening, what is Redlands Roses? What does your company do?
Hi, Deji. So Redlands Roses is a boutique farm that's located in Ruiru, just on the outskirts of Nairobi. We're a boutique farm, 43 hectares in size, and we grow spray roses for the high-end event and floral market.
Spray roses. So for the unschooled in the world of roses, can you just explain what that is? What kind of roses do you grow? What kind of system do you employ to grow the roses? And do you only grow roses, no other types of flowers? Just to educate us a bit on the floriculture market.
Yeah, sure. So Kenya as a country is an important floriculture export market, okay, alongside Colombia and Ecuador. We're the third largest flower exporter in the world, and our natural market is Europe. Within Kenya, there are many different types of flowers that are cultivated. Namely, you can divide these into two buckets. You've got roses, that is an important segment in the market, and you've also got summer flowers. Us as Redlands, we focus on the rose market and we specialize in spray roses. So, Deji, when you go to a supermarket, when you think of a rose, you think of a rose with a single stem and a single head, the classic rose. The roses that Redlands specializes in are called spray roses, where you've got one stem with multiple heads.
I see. When I saw spray, I was wondering what that was. So this is one stem with multiple heads. And what is peculiar about the way roses are grown? So I mean, I know agriculture fairly well, but I don't think I've ever been to a flower farm. Is it different from the typical agricultural produce that are products that are produced across different countries?
When you're growing a spray rose or a rose for that matter, the agricultural practices are no different. I guess what differentiates one farm from the other is whether they choose to grow in soil or whether they choose to grow hydroponically. Redlands Roses is unique in that standpoint because we're one of, I would say, like a handful, if not the only farm growing hydroponically commercially. I guess what differentiates rose growing from other types of agriculture is that it's much more labor intensive. Whereas, arable agriculture is mechanized. Rose operations all require human labor. From the planting to the crop husbandry work to the harvesting, it's all done by human hand.
Oh, I see. You can't apply mechanization because you would damage the flowers.
It's actually a hot topic at the moment. For instance, a farm in Holland. Rose growing also happens in Holland, albeit on a very small scale because they've got other challenges like rising energy costs. But greenhouses in Holland can be operated with two or three people because a lot of the operations are mechanized. Here in Kenya, our competitive edge is labor, and so we're doing a lot of those operations with human labor. I think in time to come, those operations will be mechanized.
Okay, and that wouldn't affect the flowers. Just coming back to the subject of hydroponics, I've heard a lot about hydroponic farming across different parts of the world, and it's something that is new coming to Africa, and I've not really seen myself where it has been done on at a commercial scale, just like you are describing now. So what do you think about the future of hydroponics farming in Africa? Do you think there are specific sectors like the floriculture sector that it's going to play a role in, or you think it's going to play a role in many other sectors in the agricultural sector?
So again, today, Deji, the world is changing, right? We have a lot of constraints on water. We've got environmental constraints where we're not just paying lip service to the environment, but we actually have to demonstrate as a farm what we're doing tangibly to protect the environment, i.e., preventing leaching of nutrients into the underground waterways. So environmental preservation is now a reality that needs to be factored into every business. This was essentially the genesis of Redlands Roses. It was a concern for the environment and how to grow so that we could protect the environment. And hydroponics in Kenya in 1996, when the farm was set up, was something completely unusual. Why would you do that when you can grow directly in soil? It's a much more expensive growing system, okay? But it's a system that allows you to preserve water, as I said earlier. Whatever fertigation regime you're sending through the hydroponic growing system is, passed through the plants. They uptake what they need to. You collect what you need to at, at the drainage tunnel, and you basically recycle that nutrient solution. You'll have zero leaching because you're growing in a closed loop system. So you're not growing in the soil. You're growing above soil in a medium called pumice. And so you're doing your part to conserve water and to recycle fertigation solution and prevent leaching. Okay. I believe that this is the future of hydroponic, and rather, this is the future of floriculture farming. Everybody needs to start thinking this way and heading in the direction of hydroponic growing. Hydroponic growing systems can make sense for certain crops. To my knowledge, they can make sense for, tomato growing. They can make sense for lettuce. I think there'll be limited application for some other crops like arable agriculture. So you might be limited there, but you can certainly move in that direction.
And I also see that a large part of your market is in Russia and Eastern Africa. Correct me if I'm wrong about that. But if that's the case, why that region specifically? Why not Western Europe, North America markets?
Great question. So the primary market for flowers from East Africa is Europe. Okay. And within Europe, you can play in very many different markets. When you think about the segment that we're playing in, high-end luxury florists, you need to look for markets that appreciate the types of flowers that we're growing. The second thing is, so these markets are found mainly in Eastern Europe, starting with Poland, Czech Republic, Romania, and as you head east from that direction, so Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia. These countries also tend to have a very strong affiliation with flowers. It's part of their cultural life. It's not like in Western Europe where you give flowers once, twice a year, maybe as a gift to someone. Flowers in Eastern Europe play a very important part of their cultural daily life. They offer flowers for birthdays. They offer flowers when they go to somebody's house. They also bring flowers home to decorate the home. Flowers have a very strong, important meaning in the lives of the folks that live in that part of the world.
What drew you to Redland Roses? What inspired you to take on that journey of becoming a CEO of the firm?
I've always worked in agriculture, Deji, and I started my career with arable agriculture in Africa. I'd say that that was the start of my journey, and passion in agriculture. I was working with a contract farm management company, and we were managing, farming estates in Zambia and Tanzania. And I quite enjoy being out in nature. I enjoy watching the crops grow, and yeah, being outdoors. And I believe that that was the start, really, of my journey and interest within agriculture. In the later parts of my career, I went and worked with Syngenta, where I saw a different part of agriculture, but nonetheless, I was still very much connected to this, to the outdoors. I was selling cereal herbicides and plant growth regulators in the UK market. So it was always outdoor, and that kept reinforcing that I enjoyed the job, enjoyed interacting with farmers, and I enjoyed creating, solutions for them. How I got to the opportunity of Redlands Roses was I guess a series of stars aligning, so to say. You know, through the course of my journey, you know, I'd realized that I wanted to be an operator because I enjoy delivering results. And you know, through the different opportunities that I got, I was really building myself up as an operator that could land anywhere, understand the context, and start delivering on the results. And what I mean by delivering results is delivering on a P&L. Okay. As an example, when I was at Syngenta UK, I was tasked with a £30 million cereal herbicide portfolio. I landed in the UK and we were in the season. So I had to figure out how to sell those products. And I had to figure out how to do that very quickly. I realized through that experience that I was very good at data analytics, finding trends in the market and finding gaps faster than, you know, our competitors could, and I was able to deliver on my responsibilities. So when I returned back to Kenya in 2018, you know, I didn't have opportunities to go back directly into agriculture, but I found other roles that could continue building my abilities as an operator and opportunities that could give me full P&L responsibility and not just top line responsibility. I found these opportunities not in agriculture, but in the tech sector, where you had, you know, businesses being set up in the Silicon Savannah, very good founders that were raising, you know, a lot of money, but they needed good operators to deliver on their vision. So I worked with the likes of M-Kopa, Coco Networks. I also worked for Jenga Tech Solutions Limited. And all this was to prove to myself that I could land back home in Kenya. I could speak Swahili, I could manage people, and I could deliver revenue and a bottom line. So I think staying true to what I wanted to be helped me get to the Redlands opportunity. What opened the door for me was a couple of things. So I would like to talk about number one, I went to Harvard Business School, have an MBA, and that could demonstrate basically my ability to be, you know, a generalist in managing a business. I had already demonstrated that I was an effective operator. Now what I had to do was to convince a private equity company to take a bet on me that I was somebody that perhaps didn't have the CEO on her resume, but had the qualities that could, you know, make me a good CEO, and that I just needed the private equity company to take a bet on me. How I was able to convince them was I went through the entire interview process alongside other candidates, but I was able to demonstrate when I was given one part of the assignment was to do a commercial due diligence that I could read data better than any of the other candidates, and I could quickly grasp what was happening on the farm and make informed decisions. And I believe that this is what got me to, and I could also synthesize that information to a board of directors. And I believe that that's the catalyst that landed me the job, at Redlands Roses.
Very interesting. Would you say that the bet on you by the private equity firm has paid off?
Yes, I would say that it has paid off very well for them. I think they found in me somebody that was very driven, somebody that has developed resilience, and somebody who's persevering.
Yeah. No, so very interesting, Disha. You talk about the different stars aligning. You worked as an operator. You were responsible for top line, with Syngenta UK. You moved to Kenya. You did a lot in terms of the, driving bottom line growth. Looking at your role now as CEO of Redland Roses, if you're speaking to somebody who is aspiring to become the CEO of a company, which of your different experiences will you say, has been most pivotal in your ability to execute in your current capacity as CEO?
I would say that the opportunity at Syngenta was quite instrumental in helping me to discover that I enjoy generating sales. You know, the hunger to deliver on a given objective, right? It's what can you do to be better than somebody who's been in the same position and knows already what to do? How do you take on that challenge, not get, you know, overwhelmed by it, and figure out how you're going to create an edge. I think it's it would boil it down to the hunger to deliver, the hunger for a target. And that's what the position at Syngenta UK allowed me to discover within myself. Nobody is born knowing what they want to do or what they're good at. It's a journey of discovery. As you land in certain contexts, you discover, oh, I actually quite like that. And learning how to be smarter than the market, learning how to read data, I believe that those were the things that, helped me to discover, oh, I quite like this. I can be good at it. I didn't realize that analyzing data was a valued skill set. I didn't know what the terminology data-driven decision-making was when I was at Syngenta UK. Yet that's exactly what I was doing. I was trying to figure out how am I going to be smart at selling? How am I going to make use of all the data that I have available? How can I analyze that? How can I know what the trend is of a specific pest or, in my case, pest, which is a weed in my case, and what the growth is, figure out that actually that pest is increasing within the UK. And so there is opportunity to make more money by ordering more stock. And that's essentially what I did. And it was basically a process of testing and just doing. I had nothing to lose.
And do you still, I find that quite fascinating. Do you still use data a lot in your current role? If you can just give us an example about how you still, make data-driven decisions.
I believe that one of my successes at Redlands Roses is my ability to harness all the data sets. I can give you with, 99% accuracy where I've shipped a specific stem from a specific greenhouse and to which customer it went. And that makes it a pleasure for somebody like me who's incredibly analytical to really analyze, okay, what prices am I selling at? What sort of discounts am I giving? Why are the sales team over giving certain discounts? Let's hold them to account by saying that you need to have security of X percentage of your orders and discounts should be given on the remaining 30%, as an example. So I believe that this journey that I started with Syngenta in analyzing data and taking decisions on the back of that has really been one of my key success factors at Redlands Roses.
Interesting. Very interesting. So if I'm a CEO or an entrepreneur, I'm not as analytical as you are, how can I still mine or get the benefit of making data-driven decisions? Because you've proven through two different avenues, one in Syngenta, now in Redland Roses, that data-driven decision making is a plus to anybody leading an organization, whether in Europe or in Africa. But if my mindset does not work that way, how can I still get that benefit?
By the way, anyone can get on this journey. I think it all begins with data collection, right? And accurate data collection. I can't make the decisions or do the analysis that I'm doing if the data weren't collected and it weren't collected with any type of proper rigor. That's also part of my job as an operator, right? I've described earlier that I can tell you what sort of losses we're experiencing for a specific variety. I actually regularly go out into the greenhouses and check how that data is actually being collected and whether processes are being followed. So data collection is essential and processes to collect that data is also very essential. So I think that's where it all starts. It depends on what you're trying to measure and what you want to keep track of. You want to keep track of sales, where you're selling it. You've got to create even as basic as having a spreadsheet to record, those transactions. Today we've got ERPs, we've got Odoo. The barriers to entry and start collecting that data are quite low. So it depends really what you want to collect and analyze and then what you want to do with it. And I believe in terms of the second step, our journey to basically visualize these dashboards was all the more simple because we had the data available. It was a simple matter of getting a software engineer to basically understand what sort of data sets were available and what we wanted to visualize. Once you define that, the visualization process is very simple. And I think, Deji, today with AI, this is going to get even more simple, where you don't even need that software engineer. And you can define, perhaps through an AI agent what you want to have visualized, and that can be done.
One of the things you touched on earlier today, and when we spoke last, is the fact that every single day you actually visit, your outpost to see what is happening there. So, can you walk us through what a day in your life looks like from the beginning to the end?
My day starts very early in the morning. It starts on a typical day, it starts at 4:45 in the morning. I have a gym session in the morning between 5 and 6 a.m. So I start my day with sport, and then I start to get ready, and I leave the house by 7 a.m. with my oldest daughter. I drop her to school, and once I've dropped her off to school, I make my 1 hour journey to the farm. When I get to the farm, a couple of things can happen on a typical day. I'll have one-to-one catch-ups with my direct reports, because I check in with them once a week. And they're all spread out through the week, so I have enough time to be with them to understand what they're up to during the week, what challenges they're facing, and how best to support them. What I've learned through that process is fast decision making, so as to not be the bottleneck for them to progress on deliverables. I'll also make time to go out and walk the farm. I'll always do a spot check in one of the key operating areas. Given that we're a high-end farm, highly process driven, it's really important to ensure the consistency and delivery of those processes. When I arrived at Redlands Roses, I used to wonder, why are we spending so much time to correct a small part of the process? It just doesn't matter. But I think the product that we grow is a sum of all those processes. So if you don't care about one, then you may as not well care about the others. What's the big deal? It's good enough. And then I realized, well, I'm not good enough. I am the best. So if I want to deliver a flower that's going to be sold at 6 euros, I better be the best. And so it made me realize over a period of time that all those processes mattered. The execution, the accuracy mattered. And that I needed to, in order to be successful, ensure that people within the farm, the operators, are executing those processes correctly. And the best way to do that is to go and visit the workstations. So whether it's harvesting, so for instance, earlier this week I went to the harvesting process of one of the greenhouses to check compliance on some of the processes. It shows that as a leader, I'm invested in those processes. I have knowledge of them, and that my team is aware that as the invested leader, they must too also be invested in that process to deliver on our product. On other days, I'll go to the pre-cool intake room. This is the point at which the flowers are arriving to be taken into the cold room after the harvest process. And at each place that I go, I know I have a mental checklist of the things that I'm looking for and to make sure that there's compliance. If there's not, I'll immediately flag that to the operational manager and make sure that that's factored into consideration to be corrected. And sometimes we'll also have sectional meetings. I drop into sectional meetings as I need to get a pulse check of the organization. I believe that all these things that I do is very characteristic of an operational CEO, somebody that's invested in the operations, because I believe that that's critical to delivering the product that we do. We'll have our management meeting once a week. So these are a couple of the things that I get involved in. I used to be far more involved in the sales process, at least for the first 3.5 years of the business. Now I've got a chief commercial officer, so I'm letting him, take the reins of that department. So I've, stepped back a bit, but I'm monitoring the results through the dashboards. And if the things that don't seem right, I'm basically stepping in to support and challenge where I need to.
Okay. And then when you, in the evening, when you close, what happens? You go straight home.
Yeah, so I close. I would say that my work days are fairly long, 10 and a half to 11 hours. I'll typically start my journey back home at around 6:30, quarter to 7, and it takes an hour to get back home. When I get back home, I'll see my babies, my two daughters, off to bed, and then I'll make sure that I have dinner with my husband to wind down the day and discuss what's happened. That for us is a ritual, to just catch up. My husband's my biggest support. So yeah, it's the person that I can vent to, get advice from, and I think the person that's been there to motivate me throughout this entire journey, because, as a first-time CEO, there's been moments of doubt. There are days where the rate of problems flowing at you is unprecedented, and sometimes you need that anchor to give you the confidence to get up the next day and say, no, I'm going to fight this and I'm going to take, bring it on. I can see that 4 years down the line, when I now have this unprecedented rate of problems, I'm like, bring it on. I can manage that.
Interesting. I was going to ask, you touched on it a little. You're a mother, you are a CEO, you are a wife. How do you balance all these different aspects of your life? And it seems you're doing an excellent job across all the fronts.
It's hard, Deji, and I don't believe in the word balance as such because something's got to give. If I describe to you my life right now, it's been a lot of sacrifice to get to where I'm at. As I mentioned earlier, it's long work days. It's 6 days on the farm, so it's not a complaint as such. It's to really explain that if you want to get somewhere, you got to put in the work. There's no shortcut. You've got to be dedicated to your trade, and you've got to, persevere and be resilient. And that's the choice that I made, and I was able to make that choice because, I have a strong husband who's been able to help me balance, so to say, things at home. For instance, raising our girls and being more present at home to ensure that everything around, their days, their logistics are well managed and planned. Okay, so the word balance exists, when you have a strong partner, I would say. I would also say that when I talk about something's got to give, you must know very honestly that the social life has taken a strong back seat. And sometimes it concerns me, but again, it's a choice that I've made at this point in time to focus on my career and to get where I need to be at its peak. So the two things that I would say are top of mind for me are my job and my family. I would also say that when I talk about something's got to give, you must know very honestly that the social life has taken a strong back seat. And sometimes it concerns me, but again, it's a choice that I've made at this point in time to focus on my career and to get where I need to be at its peak. So the two things that I would say are top of mind for me are my job and my family. I socialize when I can, and I believe that at some point I'll prioritize that more. But right now, I don't have the time to do that. And my general point of view on balancing is I believe that I'll get what I want, but not all at the same time. I'll be able to have more of a social life perhaps a couple of years from now. On the same note, I had 2 years in business school, a good 10 years ago. It was pure fun, pure social life for the 2 years. But at the time, I didn't have any responsibilities for work, right? And I didn't have a family. So I believe that I will get everything that I want, but not all at the same time. And it will happen over a period of time. But right now is the time for me to thrive, in this position and also to be there as a mom and as a wife for my family.
So in your experience, what has been your biggest challenge as a CEO, over the last 4 years that probably was, you talked about it, or rather you alluded to it when you were speaking now about certain things that eat you and you're like, pent up. What's one of those experiences that shook you as a CEO, if you can share that experience with us?
What I'll do, Deji, is I'll share with you something that I struggled with when I joined Redlands. In the way that I'd been formed, I was always an adapter, in the sense that I would go into an organization and I would adapt to the context. And what that meant when I landed at Redlands Roses was I adapted to the context. I adapted to a highly micromanaged system, and I adapted also to the managers that were in place at the time. And so it took me quite some time to figure out that micromanagement is not going to achieve my objective and that I need to get leverage through people. I need to get leverage through a management team. It wasn't the fault of the company because that was the way that, the founders of that business that made it, by the way, very successful, had managed that business. But you see, the context was changing because we were going to scale the business. It's very different to do things on a smaller farm when you have to do everything and manage all processes and controls. To give you a sense, I was signing the leave forms of all 500 employees at the time.
What?
I was specifically reviewing all the invoices coming in. I was reviewing all the medical bills coming in. I was making all the payments. All these processes were controls that were adequate for the company at that point in time. But there was an expectation that I was going to continue doing those processes. But then I also questioned, well, what's the purpose of all the managers? And what's the, surely there must be systems and processes that should be put in place to generate controls differently. And I also then realized through that process that there were certain managers that were not picking up their weight for the job responsibility that they were conferred. And that would mean additional work burden on me. But again, I adapted, and I adapted for a good year and a half because as a first-time CEO, I was too scared to fire anyone or to make the personnel changes that I needed. And all this, I would say, was an organic discovery that when you have a vision and you've got some objectives and you want to manage in a certain way, you need to have allies in your team. You need to have employees and colleagues that basically see the world in the same way as you. And that journey took me far longer than it should, probably because I was a first-time CEO and because I didn't want to make that difficult decision of firing anyone. But at the same time, the impact on me was the work burden and the burnout. And so the journey started a year and a half later when I made the first decision to hold somebody to account for their performance, and they resigned of their own accord. And from that point onward, it became just much easier to realize, okay, when I have the right person in place to replace that person who's left, I'm now starting to see a difference. I'm enjoying coming to work. The work burden's lighter and people are picking up their responsibilities. And so that for me now today, I coin as change management. And that's essentially what I did. Started with that first position, then I hired my technical manager. I replaced my CFO, and then I put in place a chief commercial officer. And these are the changes that I've made in the past, 2 years or so. And today I'm in a position to now think about strategic things for the business.
Okay. So there are two things I can take from some of the things that have driven your success at Redlands Roses. One, of course, is what we talked about earlier, the data-driven decision making. But the other now that I think is as important, if probably not more important, and I would like to hear that from you, are the people. What role, what weight will you place on having right people in your team in making any organization successful?
80%. It's all about people. And at least for me, I can smile about it because it was an organic realization. You can't achieve what you need to get done alone. You need to find people who are aligned to your value system and to your vision and who are self-starters.
How do you set the North Star that guides the people to know what they are working towards so that every day they wake up, you don't need to tell them what they need to do. They know exactly what they need to do and they are driving it.
What we do at the start of every year is that I have a budget seminar where I actually transparently show the team what we need to achieve collectively for the year. And that allows me to communicate my vision for the year. We do our planning in 1 year cycles, and this has worked for us to drive the performance within the year. I believe maybe in time to come, I'll look at, a longer term plan. But right now, our focus was to operationalize and to grow the business. So I kept it in the 1 year cycle to share the budget for the year. And what I then do is I share the KPIs for the year for each operational manager. So the salesperson knows what their sales target is for the year, what the average price is that they're supposed to achieve. I also have a target on the number of new customers that they need to get. And those are, I keep it very simple and I keep it smart. So it's very easy for them to understand what their targets are and how to measure the performance as the year is going on. We're on the same page from the start of the year. You know, in going about my day-to-day responsibilities, I have check-in sessions. We discuss the results actively during our catch-up sessions, and we understand whether we're on target or not and what the action plan is. So as a concrete example, we have a lot of work to get done in the sales for the second half of the year because we need to help, you know, achieve higher average prices. We need to ensure that the discounts are not so liberal. So that's how I make it very clear what I want to achieve in the year and how I get everybody on board. What we do also is we periodically share the results and we discuss it as a team. So it's not that we start this really amazing journey at the start of the year with the budget seminar, but every month we review the performance in detail through what we call a sales statistics meeting. We discuss the delivery of each operational department and we understand, well, have you achieved yes or no? What's gone wrong and what's your action plan for the next month? So we also hold to account what you're going to do collectively through a group meeting setup and not just one-on-one. So all this to say that I make it clear at the start of the year, there's weekly follow-up sessions, but there's detailed group sessions that happen once a month to review the results. And I believe that this constantly reinforces the targets and it helps each manager stay on track.
How do you find outstanding managers? What's your secret to doing that?
It's a really great question, Deji. I want to talk about two things. The first one is it's a function of your experience. I believe I've probably interviewed more than 100 people since starting at Redlands Roses. And I believe that if you're invested in the business, whether it be finance or the ops, as much as I have had the opportunity to be, you start to understand very well what you're looking for. And you're able to screen candidates better. You will make mistakes, and I have made, you know, my fair share of mistakes, but with time and experience, you get better and you will eventually develop a gut feeling. And you need to listen to your gut. I didn't believe in this and I thought it was hogwash, but I've come to understand that the feeling that you have, sometimes it's important to listen to it. And the second thing that I'd like to talk to you about is we've now reached a really wonderful stage where we're attracting really good talent because of the brand name of the business. You know, the brand is as a result of the product we produce, the customers we serve, the value we're creating. And what I'm finding is that we have people attracted to us as a brand, that want to come and work with a young team. You know, when I think about the change management part, the average age of our team is probably between 40 and 45, all our senior managers. So it's a young team. It's a fun team. And, people can see this from the outside, we're present at exhibitions. You know, we have the flower exhibition happening in Kenya once a year, early June, called IFTEX. And, you could feel the brand, you can feel the energy of a brand. You know, when we set up our stand, it's always the busiest stand. We've got majority of our team members, okay, by virtue of us being close to Nairobi, that we involve in the exhibition. You can see a certain solidarity. You can feel what it might be to work at a brand from the outside. So I believe that we're at a stage where we're attracting talent because of this energy that we emit, and also because of the brand strength of Redlands Roses.
Many people might not know you're a third generation Kenyan and you have deep roots in agriculture. Do you think that has played a role, in in who you've become today, and how significant of a role has that played?
Absolutely. I'd like to talk about my dad. He's a first generation entrepreneur, and he set up a very successful commodities trading business on the continent. And it's only today that I can appreciate how tough his journey was. Setting up shop in the middle of, African countries, take Tanzania as an example, going in the middle of the bush, setting up, depots to collect surplus ag commodity from farmers, aggregating it, cleaning it, and then trading it, all in the absence of the internet, mobile phones. So you could, today, as a somebody who's, following independently on their own, on their own journey, I have a deep appreciation for the challenges and the growth journey that he had through that process, especially having zero guidance. He didn't come from an entrepreneurial family. He barely was able to finish, he managed to finish high school and was sponsored to do his first degree in India by his uncle. But his dad, for instance, didn't have the means, beyond that. So it was really up to him to decide what to do. So I believe that that implicitly has played a very strong, I would say not even implicitly, I would say that that directly has impacted me, subconsciously. I've heard the story many times, and it's only today that I can say, yes, I think that that really helped to ensure that I myself was driven as an individual. So I credit my ability to relate to my team as a direct influence of that. The agricultural part again comes from him, and the drive also comes from him.
What advice would you give to young African women who are aspiring to leadership?
I think there's the main message I have for young women is be passionate about what you want to do and stay focused and resilient. It's the long game. It's going to feel hard at some points. It's going to feel extremely hard at other points, but keep persevering. Wake up the next day, do that 5 a.m. gym session, and have the drive to get through the day, because eventually things will fall into place. And that's exactly what's happened for me.
My last question, if you could write a diary entry to your younger self just starting out, what would you say?
Tisha, get disciplined. The reason why I say that is I learned very late in life, and I learned only at my time at Syngenta when I was heading to almost 30 years of age, what it meant to live a life with constraints. What I mean by that is this is your salary, you live within your means, and B, these are the leave days you have, and all the basics about entering employment for the first time, I would say I learned very late in life. I was very lucky in the early parts of my career to have opportunities that exposed me, but didn't necessarily confer me the discipline of what it meant to be a good employee and a good professional for that matter. I started my career in the family business. Those were really good years of my life, and I'll never exchange them for anything. I got a lot of exposure. I got to meet presidents from every African country. I got the confidence to be able to speak with them about the work that we were doing at ETG. I got exposure, but I didn't necessarily get the discipline that I needed as somebody who was 21 years starting out in her career. And I'm going to talk about basic things like arriving to work at 8 a.m. instead of at 10 a.m. I didn't earn the luxury to come to work at 10 a.m., yet I was showing up to work at 10 a.m. Have you heard of any 21-year-old who's allowed to show up to work at 10 a.m. on their first job? I think the second thing was there was no concrete deliverables or job responsibility that was conferred to me. Again, that was because of the structure of the family business. And I believe that all of these things could have made me a much better professional at the start of my career. I had a very comfortable option, right? To go back and work with a family business. What I discovered, though, when I got to business school, right, was that I was missing a lot of the basics that my colleagues had to do when they were, starting out their first jobs. You're about 4 or 5 years into your professional life when you arrive at business school. after business school, I landed in the UK and I was like, okay, just like everyone, I need to start applying for jobs. And so started applying for jobs and I started getting lots of rejections. McKinsey rejected me, BCG. I had Harvard on my resume, but I wasn't good enough. You need a certain level of ambition, determination, and focus to get into those consultancies. I did all the prep work, but I just wasn't good enough. And then eventually I was lucky enough to get accepted at Syngenta. Okay. And that's how I entered the Syngenta system. Now, even through my time at Syngenta, I wouldn't say that I was the best employee because I didn't know how to be an employee. I was learning the constraints that UDEG had already learned 10 years before me. So I was like, cool, I still have a backup option. I'm going to do this, be with Johan, and eventually go back to like Tanzania. The mindset was not right. It was basically at one point when David Morgan, my line manager, said, dude, do you realize that people expect you to deliver? And I was like, shit, this guy just told me that I do nothing. And that really impacted me for some reason. I took it to heart and I decided I'm going to show David Morgan that I can actually deliver. And I can even trace back the date. It was 2015. So exactly 10 years ago when I decided I'm going to become a delivery machine. And that's when I started to really deliver. I got a chance to be in the Africa Middle East team. I went to Morocco and then eventually got the job in the UK. I actually got the Best Employee of the Year award in the UK. I'm very lucky that post business school, I had, the opportunity to, well, the drive to pursue my own independent career path. But it was through that experience that I learned how difficult life is for majority of the world. And how much you have to hustle to get where you need to be. And I believe that those experiences have made me stronger. There are times when I think about why am I doing this and why can't I just follow the easier path? But I now have two daughters, and if I really want them to look up to me, then I better hustle so that they understand in their life that they need to hustle to get where they need to be.
Thank you very much, Disha, for sharing your insights with us. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast today.
Thanks, Deji.
Thanks for listening to the Diary of an African Entrepreneur. If you found today's episode valuable, please be sure to subscribe, share, and leave a review. It helps us to reach more entrepreneurs across the continent. Thank you very much.